Liz Palka. Islamic militants are preventing more than 1,000 civilians from leaving an area still held by the extremist group in a village in eastern Syria. That's according to a spokesman for the U.S.-backed Syrian militia fighting the group. Occasional airstrikes and clashes continue inside the village of Baghouz. The capture of the last pocket of territory held by IS in either Syria or Iraq would mark the end of a devastating four-year global campaign to end the extremist group's so-called caliphate. Iran's foreign minister on Sunday criticized the United States for having an unhealthy fixation with his country.
We have long been the target of an unhealthy fixation, let's say an obsession, which continues to this very day. The demonization of my country has been a convenient cross for seven consecutive American presidents to bear.
Mohammad Javad Zarif addressed the Munich Security Conference Sunday, a day after U.S. Vice President Mike Pence prodded European countries to follow Washington in withdrawing from the 2015 nuclear deal and to stop undermining U.S. sanctions. On Saturday, Pence also called on allies to recognize opposition leader Juan Guaido as a legitimate president of Venezuela.
The struggle in Venezuela is between dictatorship and democracy. Nicolas Maduro is a dictator with no legitimate claim to power, and Nicolas Maduro must go.
More than 20 European states have recognized Guaido, but the European Union has stopped short of fully recognizing him as interim president. Disputed President Nicolas Maduro is widely accused of vote rigging last year's election. This is VOA News. Three U.S. military transport planes loaded with humanitarian aid for Venezuela landed in Cucuta, Colombia, Saturday, adding to the tons of food and medicine waiting to cross the border. The aid sent from the U.S. and many other countries has not yet reached any Venezuelans, but instead sits in towns in Colombia, Brazil, and Curaçao. Disputed President Maduro says the aid is unnecessary and illegal. Guaido, recognized by the U.S. and other nations as Venezuela's legitimate interim president, says he has a plan to bring the aid into the country and will release the details Monday. Pakistan is shutting down its airspace and has stepped up security to welcome the arrival of Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman on Sunday. This will be the start of the Crown Prince's tour of South Asia and China. Bashir Chaudhry is an Islamabad resident and local journalist. He says bin Salman's visit will hugely benefit Pakistan, and the investment coming to the country will improve Pakistan's economic conditions, which will result in political stability. Pakistan is welcoming the Crown Prince with open arms for a visit during which he is expected to sign investment agreements worth more than $10 billion. Pope Francis called on the faithful Sunday to pray for this week's summit at the Vatican on sex abuse, calling the problem an urgent challenge of our time. He's summoned bishops to Rome this week to help him chart a way forward after decades of abuse by priests and prelates and the systematic cover-ups. Peter Isley, a survivor of clergy abuse who is now a board member of the group Ending Clergy Abuse, arrived in Rome to follow the Vatican summit.
Whatever difficulty him or discomfort this is for anybody in the papal palace, it's nothing compared to what survivors have had to undergo.
Saturday, the Vatican expelled former U.S. Cardinal Theodore McCarrick from the priesthood after being found guilty of sexual crimes against minors and adults. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert on Saturday said she has withdrawn her name from consideration for the post of U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. President Trump had announced in December he was picking Nauert to fill the vacancy caused when Nikki Haley stepped down. Media reports said late Saturday, Nauert has withdrawn due to complications surrounding her employment of a nanny who was in the country legally but not legally allowed to work. A fire tore through 200 slum homes early Sunday in the Bangladesh port of Chittagong, killing at least 8 people. I'm Liz Palka, VOA News.
لا شك أن الإرهاب بات ظاهرة دولية لها مخاطر.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga. Peter Kilote is still away on assignment.
لا شك أن الإرهاب بات ظاهرة دولية لها مخاطر متعاظمة تؤدي إلى زعزعة استقرار المجتمعات.
He says that terrorism has become an ugly international phenomenon that destabilizes countries, and it is the duty of all nations to help to uproot it.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi says terrorism destroys societies and hinders economic development, and it must be fought by all.
I'm completely disappointed. I'm so shocked at INEC's decision. There's no respect for the Nigerian citizen. The timing was so poor. And all you can tell us as an excuse is about logistics. You had 4 years to plan for this election.
Nigerians express concern and frustration over delayed elections.
We get students from all over Africa that have at least 3 years of university education. The majority of them are usually at the master's level. They come from different fields, nuclear and high energy physics, medical applications.
And we look at the African School of Physics that aims to harness the talent and energy of African youth in scientific research and development. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Following a terrorist attack on Egyptian military personnel in the northern Sinai region of Al-Arishi that resulted in 15 casualties, Egyptian President al-Sisi told a security gathering in Munich that terrorism destroys societies and hinders economic development and that it must be fought by all. Edward Yerenian reports for VOA from Cairo.
كما نفذت القوات الخاصة من الصاعقة والمظلات للجانبين عملية ناجحة للقضاء على بؤرة إرهابية مسلحة.
A recent Egyptian military video shows security forces battling terrorists in a semi-urban setting. Arab media reported the terrorist attack Saturday took place at a military checkpoint outside the northern Sinai town of Al-Arish, not far from the town of Sheikh Zawayid, the scene of previous terror attacks. Egyptian army spokesman Tamer al-Rifai wrote on his Facebook page that 14 soldiers and an officer were killed and wounded, adding that the army responded by killing 7 Islamic militants. The attack reportedly took place about dawn. Islamic State is claiming responsibility for the attack through its Amaq news agency, though the group offered no proof for its claim. Several Arab news channels reported that terrorists with ties to Islamic State were behind the Sinai attack. Egypt launched a major military campaign against terrorism in the northern Sinai more than a year ago, and there has been a noticeable drop in the level of terrorist attacks in that area, although the region remains restive. The Egyptian military has created a buffer zone with nearby Gaza, in addition to destroying numerous tunnels from Gaza into the Sinai. The BBC Arabic service reported the Egyptian military also cleared a buffer zone around Al-Arish airport after a failed terrorist attack on a plane carrying the country's defense minister and army chief. It did not specify when the alleged attack took place. VOA could not independently confirm the story. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who addressed the Munich Security Conference Saturday, said terrorism is a burden for many countries in the region and that all nations should join forces to combat it.
لا شك أن الإرهاب بات ظاهرة دولية لها مخاطر متعاظمة
He says that terrorism has become an ugly international phenomenon that destabilizes countries, and it is the duty of all nations to help to uproot it, since it is a major threat to economic development. He urges the international community to combat groups that practice terrorism and countries that support those groups. Libya's eastern military spokesman, Colonel Ahmed al-Masmari, indicated in an interview Saturday that his forces also are fighting terrorist groups being sponsored by outside countries. He says the Libyan army under Eastern Military Commander General Khalifa Haftar is working to wipe out terrorism and foreign mercenaries that fuel it, along with countries that support it. Colonel al-Masmari said that his forces have dismantled a terrorist axis supported by both Qatar and Turkey. Both countries deny they support terrorism. Khattar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that terrorism has both local and regional causes. He says that terrorism increased in Egypt after the Muslim Brotherhood was ousted in 2013, as was the case in Algeria when the Islamists were overthrown in 1992, causing a bloody 10-year reign of terrorism. He says outside countries also support terrorists in Egypt, but the Egyptian government has traditionally had bad relations with the Bedouin tribes in the northern Sinai, which makes the region a fertile ground for unrest. Abu Diab speculated the current campaign to crush the Islamic State group in Syria and Iraq may be causing some terrorists to flee to other places like the Sinai. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Following Saturday's postponement of elections in Nigeria, just hours before polls were to open, many Nigerians are expressing anger and frustration. For VOA, Gift Agiriga sought reactions from some Nigerians on the streets of Abuja.
I am just depressed and I'm saddened by this postponement of the presidential election scheduled to hold today by INEC. It is very unfortunate. No apologies, no considerations, plans destroyed, manpower, time, energy, meetings postponed. Oh no, I'm depressed, I'm saddened, I'm not happy. There must be consequences.
To tell you the truth, the Independent National Electoral Commission, INEC, has shattered the plans of all Nigerians. How can they, 5 hours to the election, come up with this postponement? This is unacceptable. There is no apology from INEC. My sister's wedding is scheduled to hold on this Saturday, 23rd. Now the election has been shifted to that same date. We're so devastated. It's a national embarrassment, and we deserve an apology from INEC.
This is the first of its kind in the history of Nigeria that the election will be postponed on the very day of the election. It is very, very unfortunate. What happened to some of us that have abandoned our businesses to travel all the way to our various polling units to exercise our franchise? What happens to foreign observers, the presidents that have come to Nigeria to observe this election? What happens to the schools that have closed their doors to our children so for the participation in the election? It is quite unfortunate. We are disappointed and I'm not frustrated. I don't know what to do. I have to still go back.
I'm completely disappointed. I'm so shocked at INEC's decision. There's no respect for the Nigerian citizen. The timing was so poor, and all you can tell us as an excuse is about logistics. You had 4 years to plan for this election. So it's a total disappointment. And I would say that this election, whether they like it or not, will come out en masse and still vote come the 23rd of February.
Those were Nigerians on the streets of Abuja, beginning with 30-year-old Chinedu Cham, a civil servant from Kaduna State, 31-year-old Chioma Attah from Garki, Abuja, a public servant, 34-year-old Emmanuel Ocharifu, a businessman resident in Abuja but who traveled to Benue State, his hometown, to cast his vote, and 27-year-old Kem Best, an undergraduate from Abuja, Nigeria. A unique project is making strides in breaking down community resistance towards international efforts to contain the spread of the deadly Ebola virus in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, IFRC, has teamed up with the U.S.-based Centers for Disease Control, CDC, to collect, analyze, and implement new strategies in real time to tackle the major concerns of people faced with this dreaded disease. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Latest World Health Organization figures put the number of Ebola cases at 829, including 521 deaths. Officials say containing the spread of this deadly virus will depend largely upon getting communities to cooperate with healthcare workers. This involves gaining their trust by overcoming the fears and misinformation that exist in Ebola-affected communities. Red Cross volunteers mainly come from the communities in which they work and understand their cultures and traditions. Health workers say getting feedback on Ebola from communities in conflict-ridden North Kivu and Ituri provinces is critical in tackling this crisis. IFRC Community Engagement Senior Advisor Ombretta Baggio says information gathered from surveys is problematic. So she tells VOA, Red Cross volunteers no longer prompt people to answer a list of survey questions. Now, she says, they listen.
We have conversation with them around their concerns around Ebola, what they want to know from us around Ebola, so the questions they have, the beliefs, the systems that they have, the rumors that they're listening in their communities. And during these conversations, the volunteers share information around issues that are of concern for the communities.
Baggio says the Red Cross has just finished an analysis of the data collected from Beni, where the Ebola outbreak was first detected in August. By listening, she says Red Cross volunteers have learned about the fears and concerns people have about the treatment centers where infected people are isolated from their families. After the data is coded and categorized, she says it is shared with the Centers for Disease Control.
CDC does the quality assurance of the data, and they interpret this data in a way that is user-friendly for the response partners. This analysis helps our volunteers understand what are the most prominent questions that in that space of time communities are asking.
Traditional burial practices play a key role in the spread of Ebola. Christine Prue, a health scientist with the CDC, leads the project. She says providing safe and dignified burial services is one of the major pillars and interventions in reducing the spread of the disease.
So we analyzed all that data and sent the reports back to Red Cross and saying, is there a way for family members to be, a safe way for family members to be involved? Their teams on the ground figure it out. So our analysis of the information they provided and our question saying, can you do things differently to bury them in a way that could include family members was totally their action on our information. So they've changed their processes to allow community members to participate in a safe way.
Prue says there's been a shift in people's confidence around burials. But as one problem is solved, she tells VOA, others arise. She says the Red Cross will have to adapt its programs to meet these different needs.
I do think, and generally, the pattern that they have set is really good, but I don't think we can ever be satisfied that one way is going to be the only way, which actually reinforces the need for these kinds of feedback systems. Because every community is going to experience threat. Every community is going to either invite or involve people, outsiders, insiders, in different ways.
The World Health Organization cites Katwa and Butembo as the remaining major health zones of concern. It says community mistrust, especially in Katwa, is high. Consequently, it says people are reluctant to report suspected cases and bring infected people in for early treatment. Red Cross advisor Baggio says an additional problem is health workers are unable to access several areas in Katwa because of the conflict. However, she says the lessons learned from the project's analysis will be implemented in areas where they can work. She says volunteers will no longer deal with Ebola in a general way. Instead, she says, they will focus on and respond to the precise concerns articulated by the communities in Katwa. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Meanwhile, UN aid workers warn the deprivation suffered by tens of thousands of Syrian civilians stranded at the remote Rabkan makeshift camp on the border with Jordan is likely to continue well into the future. Again, Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations and the Syrian Arab Red Crescent recently completed the delivery of desperately needed food and other relief to more than 40,000 Syrians in Rukban. This was only the second time a UN humanitarian convoy was able to reach this harsh desert outpost with life-saving assistance since Syria's civil war began. It is uncertain when and if another convoy will be allowed to enter the region. Most of the inhabitants are women and children who fled to the camp from territory held by Islamic State militants. Many have lived in this no man's land in extremely dire conditions for years. The UN reports the region lacks basic services and has limited access to clean water. Aid agencies describe the overall health conditions there as catastrophic. UN refugee spokesman Andrei Mihecic says women, children, and the disabled are the most vulnerable. He says many have no support and are left to fend for themselves. As a consequence, he says many are forced into engaging in what he calls negative coping mechanisms.
Early marriages are common among girls. Some women have been subjected to serial marriages, and some have told us that they had turned to survival sex as a last resort. Many women are essentially terrified to leave their mud huts or tents and to be outside, as there are serious risks of sexual violence, sexual abuse and harassment.
Mihecic says thousands of children cannot afford to attend school. He says most children born in Rukban have no birth certificates or other civil documents, essentially rendering them stateless. While in Rukban, he says UNHCR staff carried out a survey which indicates most people want to go back home. Unfortunately, he says no sustainable solution to their plight is in sight. Without that, he warns, families stuck in the unforgiving, horrible environment of Rukban have no chance for a better future. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The African continent is brimming with talent and energy, but generally lack the material resources and opportunities to lead the world in scientific research and development. Katevi Asmagan, a high-energy particle physicist, is trying to change that. Raised in Togo and now living in the U.S., Asmagan co-founded the African School of Physics with the continent's youth specifically in mind. VOA's Adam Phillips has the story.
That's the CERN Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. It's a 27-meter circular tunnel that beams tiny particles at each other, almost at the speed of light. The collisions offer physicists a glimpse into what the universe may have been like mere moments after its creation. Katevi Asmagan, who has worked at CERN, experiments with a similar, albeit smaller, device at the U.S. government's Brookhaven National Laboratory in Upton, New York.
Yeah, we try to understand how the universe started in a very fundamental way as a system of fundamental particles that interact with each other. How from small things we have large-scale structures in the universe, from stars to galaxies and so forth.
Asmagan owes his position at Brookhaven both to his own talent and to the professors back in Togo who recognized that talent and helped him obtain a scholarship in the U.S., where he received his doctorate in 1995. Gratitude to his mentors fueled his desire to start the African School of Physics in 2010.
I didn't forget it. Sometimes people just need some help to be able to find the right resources. So together with some colleagues, we decided to create this school.
The school meets for 3 weeks every 2 years in a different African capital. Each session brings together 80 students from a pool of about 350 applicants. They are then treated to intensive lectures by top-flight physicists from around the world.
We get students from all over Africa that have at least 3 years of university education. The majority of them are usually at the master's level. They come from different fields, nuclear and high-energy physics, medical applications, computing, mathematics, and theoretical physics. So they have a range of background.
After completing the program, participants are paired with senior mentors who offer advice on further education, teaching opportunities, and how to secure lab time for collecting data at research centers and universities both in Africa and abroad. Helping primary and secondary school science teachers to be more effective is also crucial to the school's mission. Samagan says that when he was in secondary school in Togo, science was taught straight from secondhand textbooks from abroad. There was no experimentation.
You see the apparatus in the book, but direct involvement of the students in terms of playing with things and getting mentally challenged by trying to figure it out was not really there. And we want to resolve that.
The 70 or so science teachers who attended the school's 2018 session in Namibia were taught hands-on experiments that could be performed with scant equipment and resources. For example, using only a small plastic box with an aluminum plate, tinfoil, styrofoam, pure alcohol, and dry ice, high school students can build a tabletop cloud chamber that detects cosmic particles from outer space. Another experiment teaches physics to younger children by way of art. Kids simply drip paint on a canvas, tilted at various angles, then observe the patterns it makes as it descends.
And from that, you can then start introducing the idea of gravity and then relating things falling down to the Earth going around the sun as being driven by the same force.
Kitevi Asamagan predicts a bright future for African physics in spite of the obstacles. The talent and the will are there, he says. What's needed are more digital libraries, continent-wide access to high-speed internet, political will, and hard work. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
A team of Australian paleontologists and volunteers have saved the once-in-a-lifetime fossil discovery from devastating floods in Queensland state. From Sydney, Phil Masser reports.
The dinosaur tracks give a rare insight into an ancient world. Found on an outback farm near the Queensland town of Winton, 1,100 kilometres from Brisbane, they're estimated to be almost 100 million years old. The footprints are stamped into a large slab of sandstone rock and were made by a sauropod, a giant creature with a long neck and tail, and by two smaller dinosaurs. Some of the footprints are up to a metre wide and come from the Cretaceous period. Scientists were alerted to the danger posed to this remarkable collection when it was partly damaged by severe flooding last year. For 3 weeks, scientists and volunteers worked to carefully dig up and relocate the dinosaur tracks. They're being stored at the Australian Age of Dinosaurs Museum in Winton, where they will eventually go on display. David Elliott is the museum's executive chairman.
We really want to preserve the integrity of the tracks. We don't want to just tear them up and go and plonk them on the ground somewhere. You know, they have to be done a certain way. We can't just leave it here because that's, you know, kind of a lifetime.
Dinosaur tracks are rare in Australia. Steve Porripat, a paleontologist at Swinburne University in Melbourne, says the footprints were saved from recent monsoonal flooding in Queensland.
The imperative was to get those soft footprints out of the ground because they just wouldn't have lasted in another flood now that they've been fully exposed. To get it all out of the ground to make sure that it's safe from future floods is fantastic.
Monsoonal rains in Queensland have caused chaos, flooding hundreds of homes and drowning several hundred thousand livestock. Officials said it was a one-in-a-100-year event, and they've warned it could take years to rebuild the local cattle industry. As the floodwaters recede on land, they're polluting parts of the Great Barrier Reef. Experts say plumes of polluted water are stretching up to 60 kilometres from the coast, putting more pressure on coral that suffered mass bleaching in recent years. When ocean temperatures increase, corals can expel the algae that live in their tissues, causing the coral to turn completely white. The Great Barrier Reef is Australia's greatest natural treasure and stretches 2,300 kilometres down Australia's northeast coastline. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is the Voice of America in Washington, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. And still to come in the second part of the program, sports. A commentary by Dr. James Jonah and our Sunday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent. And in Nightline Africa sports, RS Bakane, Nkana, Asante Kotoko and Petro Atlantico all won their second matches in the group stage of the Confederation Cup. Renaissance Bakane went top of Group A as they came from behind to beat visiting fellow Moroccans Hassania Agadir 2-1. Holders Raja Casablanca, the third team from Morocco in the group, were surprisingly held to a goalless draw in Rabat by Congo-Brazzaville visitors AS Otoho Oyo. Bakane have 4 points. Six-time CAF title winners Raja and Otoho 2 each, and Agadir 1 in a section hard call after just 2 rounds. In Group B, the woodwork helped Nigeria's Enugu Rangers preserve their unbeaten record with a 1-1 draw with CX Sfaxien in Tunisia on Wednesday. The other match in the group also ended in a stalemate as Salitas drew 0-0 with Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel in Burkina Faso. The two draws mean Enugu and Sfaxien have 4 points each, with the Nigerians first on goal difference, while Etoile and Salitas have 1 point each. In Group C, Zambian club Nkana maintained a record of never losing a continental club match at home by fighting back to edge Sudanese visitors Al Hilal 2-1. Nkana stretched their unbeaten run in all African competitions to 57 matches, winning 41 and drawing 16 at various Zambian venues. Former African champions Asante Kotoko of Ghana defeated the other Zambian challengers, Zesco United, 2-1 in Kumasi. The results leave all four Group C clubs with 3 points from 2 games. In Group D, Algerian visitors N.A. Hussein Day snatched a dramatic 1-1 draw against host Zamalek in the Egyptian city of Alexandria. Angola's Petro Atlantico beat Kenya's Gor Mahia 2-1 in Luanda. Meanwhile, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has set new dates for Ismaili's Champions League games after the Egyptian club's reinstatement to the competition. CAF originally disqualified Ismaili after crowd trouble brought an early end to their Group C home game with Tunisia's Club Africain on January 18th. As a consequence of the ban and appeal process, Ismaili were unable to play their home and away matches against Algeria's CS Constantine. Ismaili will now host the Algerians on February 23rd, while the reverse fixture will be a week later. In the Champions League, Tanzania's Simba avenged a 5-0 mauling at the hands of Egypt's Al Ahly with a 1-0 win in Group D. That was one of the standout results on the fourth day of matches in the continent's Premier Club competition. Defending champions Esperance have the lead in their pool after a second win of the group stage. There were also wins for Guinea's Haroya and JSS of Algeria. The other 3 matches ended in goalless draws. Former champions AS Vita Club of DR Congo are bottom, having conceded a late goal away from home to go down 1-0 to Algeria's JSS. The reigning champions Esperance of Tunisia continue the defense of their title with a 2-0 win over visiting Orlando Pirates of South Africa in a match played behind closed doors because of previous crowd trouble. Esperance have 8 points from their 4 matches so far and lead Pool B by a single point from Guinea's Haroya. Captain Onkanse Mandela and Yakub Hudu scored the goals which saw Haroya beat Zimbabwe's FC Platinum 2-0. Platinum have only 1 point to their name so far. And the last time Tunisian club Africaine met TP Mazembe, the Congolese multiple former champions, they were thrashed 8-0. However, on Tuesday, the two clubs settled for a goalless draw. Mazembe are clear at the top of this pool with 7 points from 4 games. But the picture is clouded because Egypt's Ismaili and CAS Constantine of Algeria have played only 2 matches so far. And with 2 games remaining in the group phase for most teams, Nigeria's Lobi Stars still have a chance of making it through after a well-fought goalless draw in Morocco with Wydad Casablanca. Lobi Stars have 4 points from 4 games, which leaves them bottom of Pool A, tied with ASEC Mimosa of Ivory Coast, who are held to a goalless draw by South Africa's visiting Mamelodi Sundowns. Sundowns and Wydad both have 7 points, but it is the South Africans who top the pool on head-to-head record. Finally, in boxing, Britain's Anthony Joshua will fight in the US for the first time when he defends his IBF, WBA and WBO world heavyweight titles against Jarrell Miller on June 1st. 29-year-old Joshua will take on Miller at Madison Square Garden in the undefeated America's home city of New York. Miller, with 23 wins and a draw, has never fought for a world title. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday here on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent.
Nina midadi kaya rumba, kibao kata kinyonga, ufukoni na mavumba, lungu nichili na sunta, yani bo 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 bo, kana niko shaga ro o o o, yani nasimama de 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 de, kakitingisha wo 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 wo, baby girl dance for me one time, ni unofeni kunata, tena jifunge na ngata, vile za kibao. Katika, 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 yani katoto kami, kako ningingi, kamekazika ningingi, nyuma mbwi, kako mbwi mbwi, kana misifa shangingi, likavizia kitambo, leo kame nasa chambo. Karambo kana michezo ngoma sindi mbali zombe na ninampatia zabuani muogo aja ngombe yani kana niko shaga ro o o o pagana simama de 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 kakitingisha wo 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 hola ona tembea yani siwezi kutembea cheche mena cheche mea yani hadi nalegea katika 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 maumivu na ugulia mwiba ukizama na hisi mateso utamu na ngangania ndizi kwa nyama napata mchecheto na kuna nazi kwa mkongo jo na unga mchuzi wa soto jo unola rosti rojo rojo mikunjo flani wa bogo jo kibao kata tenteme teteme kilingeni kuzama uchutame huwezi pata we mpaka usimame haichagwe mbamba munene nikalaze kwa bedi kitanda nikachezeshe samba nakalivo na body kinanda tungulizi meni bamba katika 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 katika
your boy, Jeff. Oh.
Bokona a new system in the Ugandan system. Lord, it's sin. And of it, songs of it. Would it do not pour it on? It is a standing in bam. The no gets an umbam. A bomb, you please, boy, me begging you, please. Dimu physically fit. You body me only medicine. And to me, at what is that piece? I only baba when you tell me baba. I go low when you tell me go low. I lay low when you tell me lay low. I go down for you. I kill one for you. Kubika and kubikura. Zen kubika and kubikura. I love you. Me need a reply. Zen kubika and kubikura. Kubika and kubikura. Kubikula. I love you, me need a reply. Zen kubika nen kubikula bala. So make it kuliko. Cause you love baby, tsumuluzo. Edit and izalela tiligwa titia. Kuwa gida mbuja kase pichiko. Baby, will you get along for me? Will you spend it all on me? Baby, will you get along for me? Will you spend it all on me? I am the baba when you tell me baba. I go low when you tell me go low. I lay low when you tell me lay low. I go down for you, I kill one for you. Kubika and kubikula. Zen kubika and kubikula. I love you, me need a reply. Zen kubika and kubikula. Kubika and kubikula. Zen kubika and kubikula. I love you, me need a reply. Zen kubika and kubikula. Mpagira go. Mpagira go. Champion loving, champion kissing. You know you got champion loving. And when you kiss me, boy, you consume me. Champion loving, champion kissing. You know you got champion loving. And when you kiss me, boy, you consume me. Kubika and kubikula. Zen kubika and kubikula. I love you, me need a reply. Zen kubika and kubikula. Kubika and kubikula. Zen kubika and kubikula. I love you, me need a reply. Zen kubika and kubikula.
Kill the dance floor. Yes, the Omar Rafiki on another one. Boss man.
Cause I just
you know I deserve to be the one that takes you high. Timwili chumbali kila kona benzi telipa pangonjera uba kama tanga sekera kwa vino vya paikopo kutoka mazape.
And that was our Sunday music spot on Netline Africa from the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. At the 32nd ordinary session of the African Union, President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi of Egypt assumed the chairmanship of the organization. The baton was passed on to him by President Kagame of Rwanda. In his acceptance speech, President Sisi pledged that he will use his best efforts to strengthen the organization and particularly its capacity to conduct peacekeeping and engage in the settlement of disputes. The assumption of the chairmanship by Egypt may be reminiscent of the key role played by Egypt's Pan-Africanist president, Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was one of the founding fathers of the Organization of African Unity in 1963. President Sisi only last April renewed his mandate for another four-year term that would end in 2022. But last week, the Egyptian parliament adopted some amendments to Egypt's constitution that will change the number of years of the mandate of a president. Now, it is proposed that the president of Egypt should have a six-year instead of four-year term, although it will still be for two terms. The key here is that the plan calls for President Sisi to have another 2 6-year term if the change in the constitution is accepted in a referendum. This means that President Sisi could continue in office until 2034. This may mark the reemergence in Egypt of the strong man. During the Tahrir demonstration in 2011, there were many who believed that there would be radical change in the political culture of Egypt. It is true that the so-called Arab Spring and the demonstration in Tahrir Square caused the downfall of President Mubarak and changes which brought about the election of the first civilian president, Mohamed Morsi, in Egypt. But we know that shortly after his election, then General Sisi carried out the coup d'etat that removed him after major domestic demonstration against President Morsi. At the time of the Tahrir demonstration, many commentators believed that Egypt wanted a new change. What they did not take into account is that while the major cities and the young may want a change in the democratic demonstration, the larger group in the rural areas prefers stability. Now become very clear. And this new constitution, if approved, will enhance the role of the military in the life of the Egyptian people. But also, the assumption of the chairmanship of the African Union may indicate that Egypt wants to He knew its vigorous role in foreign and national affairs. Apart from the fact that Egypt is now playing a role in negotiations between Israel and Gaza, Egypt's role in Middle East affairs has diminished compared to the time of Gamal Abdel Nasser. Today, Middle East affairs are conducted by the outside powers represented by the so-called Sochi group under the President of Russia and the Warsaw group, which has now American influence. So this will enable Egypt to devote its skills in Egypt to ensure that Africa plays a key role in the matters of the international community, which today is very low. So while one should take into account that President Sisi has his own domestic critics, particularly in the human rights community, there is no doubt that he will be able to do a great deal in his chairmanship of the African Union. Africans, therefore, should pay special attention to the chairmanship of the new President Sisi of the African Union. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From all of us here at Nightline Africa, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Saida Hamdon, I'm Douglas Impuga, wishing you a very good evening.
This is VOA News. I'm